Blog Talk Radio.
All right. Good morning, everybody. Good morning. Welcome to Behind the Blue Curtain. We were gone last week, but we're back this week. Got to say good morning to the Facebook crew. It's loading up right now. And there's just so much to talk about. It's amazing everything that happens in a week. But we're here. Let's go around the horn and say good morning to everybody. Big Joe finally made it in. What's up, bro?
What's up, man?
Another day in paradise. Chief, how are you?
I'm good. Good morning, everybody. Good to be back and ready to get moving.
Big John, what's up?
Oh, man, I had a trying week, but I'm here, ready to go. Talk about your weeks, man. I mean, you had an amazing weekend last weekend.
Oh, yeah, man. My niece got married, went back up to Harrisburg, saw some high school and childhood friends I hadn't seen in years. Got me a big-time mother sub, man. Oh, man. I mean, put Jimmy John's and Jersey Mike's to shame. You know, so shout out to Harrisburg, once again, ATL, Waco, Texas. I'll see you guys next month. And before we get into today's topic, because we have to talk about this defund the police insanity, and we're going to go into that. But before we do, Joe brought up a very good point of something that I think we need to talk about and remember. Big Joe?
Yeah, we were talking about this for a quick second, and it's scary because the fact that law enforcement didn't know about it is telling them what's going on. The last week, the FBI and DHS actually issued a memo, actually in June, I believe. I'll post it in a minute. They actually issued a memo, an advisory, a terrorism advisory, based on the Buffalo shooter's manifesto. You would think something of that nature would be frontline news, but it wasn't. And shame, because it says, the first line, the United States remains in a heightened threat environment. As noted in the previous bulletin, several recent attacks have highlighted the dynamic and complex nature of the threat environment. In the coming months, we expect the threat environment to become more dynamic. Those two lines should be a wake-up call for everybody. Now, again, unfortunately, this is not known. I mean, here we are, a podcast group, and I can tell you, and I'm not throwing it at anybody in particular, law enforcement, even my friends here didn't know about it. I had to call some guys at my old department and say, hey, man, have you seen this? They're like, what are you talking about? And I sent them a copy, and I'll post it to the board. But the opening line by itself should tell you we got a problem right here in River City.
Well, and that's the thing. Nobody wants to focus on it, and you have those inner department. I know something you don't know. We've all experienced that. We'll tell you some of it. It's on a need-to-know basis. But when these things, these repeat copycats, when they happen, it's the men and women on the street that are going to be the first ones to have to deal with it, and they don't know. Chief, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the interdepartmental communication from federal, state, and local, that's always been, you know, an issue that we've had to try to overcome to gather information. I think it's gotten better since the time I've been in law enforcement. But I know that I certainly have to take it upon myself to go find a lot of that information. And then Joe shared that information with me. And, you know, so I didn't know about it when he sent it to me. So I started digging and looking a little forward and preparing, you know, what is it that we needed to do in order to respond to something like this. So, yeah, it becomes an issue. I'm not a big fan of we'll give you these pieces. I get if it's an investigation, you know, and we just can't let a whole bunch of stuff out. I fully 100% get that. But you're right, the men and women that are going to be on the street today, tomorrow, next week, if they don't have that in their mind, that's, you know, this is an issue that is potentially going to come up. I mean, I say that they should be thinking about that anyway. You know, they should think about that on a daily basis, that this thing is going to happen, because that's how we try to train. And that's today's world and today's environment. But, you know, they need to be cognizant of that type of stuff. And if we have information, fresh information that says, hey, these are the, this is something that's going to come up and we're going to see it here pretty soon, that officer that's going to the local grocery store needs to be aware and to think about that. So it becomes very important that information is shared across the board. You don't have to give all of it to us, but it would be nice to have some snippets. Now, I'm hoping that wherever they've encountered this information or wherever they've come up with it, I'm hoping it's pinpointed to a specific area. But from what I read, it doesn't indicate that at all. So that's pretty scary right there.
Chief, what about the citizens? Don't you think that because good policing has a lot to do with the community, because the community is working with the police and keeping the citizens on a high alert, I think helps you guys. But
I think
you guys being in the blind and then we're in the blind, you know, I think it's unfair to both parties.
Yeah, I do too. And I mean, I think there's a measure there. Yeah, because, and again, sometimes, and again, I agree with you. I think citizens should be aware of pretty much everything that's going on, especially with stuff like that. And kind of like when we had back in the day, we had the terrorism, you know, bulletins or the levels or whatever we had. At least people knew kind of there was something going on there. But I don't necessarily know. You got to be very, very careful in how you disseminate information, because then you have the potential to spread some panic. You know what I mean? You got to balance the two, you know. And I mean, again, this information that Joe put out, he shared with me, I had no information about it whatsoever. So I knew that nobody else, if I hadn't seen it, and other people in my profession hadn't seen it, I was almost positive nobody else knew about it. So I don't know at that level. And again, it's you know, I can tell folks, but I don't know. Since I don't have enough information from the bulletin, from what they've given us, I don't know if that's necessarily appropriate to put out, you know, I mean, other than, hey, like every day, you need to be aware of your surroundings, for practice situational awareness wherever it is you go. I mean, and I do tell people that all the time.
It seems to me like when it comes to home, domestic terrorism, America is too embarrassed to call terrorism in America.
Yeah.
If you just brought up 9/11, right? After 9/11, they put the whole country on high alert. But why, when it comes to these groups, we don't want to label them as terrorists? We don't want to call the acts terrorist acts. We don't even want to alert the people to be on high alert for the terrorism that's domestic, that's within. So it seems like there's almost an embarrassment to call things what they are here in America when it's homeborn.
I don't disagree with you.
I would totally agree with you on that one, John. The fact of the matter is that they are making Black Lives Matter a terrorist group and just notified and said that KKK was on. Now, to my knowledge, I don't know any people that the Black Lives Matter group have killed, but I can tell you I know a lot of people that KKK have killed. So, and to the chief point, there are issues that should not be disseminated, because you can cause, the best way to put this is, the analogy would be this: you cannot yell fire in a
theater.
You know, now, if there is one, that's one thing, but there's a way to do that if that's the correct thing. But the other problem is this: police departments across this country are not trained, right now, not in my eyes, are not trained for a terrorist attack. We are not ready.
But you are, and I think...
Police department that's ready for, because first of all, you got to recognize that it is one. Then the second part is, how do you respond? The third part is, do you have the equipment to respond?
But Joe, the first part is key, because I don't think America is capable of recognizing and acknowledging a homegrown terrorist, which was evident January 6th.
Well, I see, that goes to something John just said. I think their fully potential is we are fully capable of recognizing. Will we recognize?
Right.
So to John's point, they are, for lack of a better term, too embarrassed or just blatantly blind to what actually is. I mean, look, come on, fellas, let's recognize what it is. We're just, black folks are just getting the right to vote in the last 50 years. Come on, it's because you've been around for 400 years. And they're just giving a certain segment the right to vote. They're just giving women rights because they're women. Does it surprise you that we're not admitting that we've got a problem? There's a question.
Mm-hmm. And I don't think anybody's really surprised by that. But it's funny because I think it ties into, while I don't agree with the defund the police comment or analogy or movement or whatever it is, because we'll talk about today, there's a whole lot of things that come with that that the general public isn't aware of. But
yes.
I think also I think we have to acknowledge some of the people who brought into it off of their personal experience. And while, you know, I know people say, well, you know, that's just a one-time incident. That's just, you know, I don't want those lights behind me. And you hear on the traffic stops all the time, well, I need you to get out of the car because you seem nervous. You're sweating. I drove one of those cars 25 years. If I get pulled over, depending on where I am, I'm going to be nervous, and I'm probably going to be sweating. And it's not because, you know, yeah, every encounter doesn't end as a bad encounter. To also deal with the fact that Murphy's Law, what if it's just my day? You know, so it's some of it. But I want to play a video real quick of an incident that happened here recently that, to me, while I do not agree with the defund the police movement, this video shows where some people would look at it and want to see that movement go forward. Let me see. Here we go.
A Florida sheriff's deputy has resigned, coming under fire after a traffic stop involving a pregnant woman. The officer following the woman on a dark rural road before she pulled over, then pulling out his gun and handcuffing her three children in the car. And tonight what the sheriff is now saying about that deputy's actions. Here's ABC's Faith Abubak.
I'm pregnant, sir. I'm 4 months pregnant, okay?
Tonight, a Florida sheriff's deputy is off the job after this harrowing moment when he pulled a gun on a pregnant woman during a traffic stop.
You make any movement, that'll be your last mistake you're going to make.
Ebony Washington coming to a stop here at this Bradford County gas station after Deputy Jacob DeSue tried pulling her over Friday night for speeding.
Your excuse means nothing to me right now. I don't want to hear it.
Washington explaining she was scared of stopping in the dark, but the deputy appears angry, accusing her of being, quote, shady for not stopping immediately when she heard his siren and flashing lights.
I'm just telling you why. I don't care about why. Just shut up.
Washington's three children, including a one-year-old, in the SUV at the time, one of them recording the terrifying moment. The mother of three saying she partly blames herself for speeding, but is still shaken.
I was so nervous, so scared. I mean, the gun part, it was just extreme for me.
The officer later removed Washington's handcuffs and issued her a citation for speeding. Bradford County Sheriff Gordon Smith saying his review of video of the incident shows Deputy DeSue's actions were inappropriate and inconsistent with department policy.
She's playing to him, you know. She's flashing lights to get to a lit area. Okay, well, that's what I want my wife to do. That's what I want my daughter to do. That's what I want my neighbor to do if you feel unsafe.
And when Officer DeSue was asked to resign, and he did after the video surfaced, ABC News has reached out to him for a comment, but we have not heard back. Whit?
Faith, thank you.
Hi, everyone. George Stephanop.
Okay. Now, that video is important because this stuff still continues to happen. I'm going to give the sheriff credit because I believe if it had not been for a lot of the social justice movement that has taken place, that incident never would have been reported. That guy probably still would have been on the job. So I think there is some level of reform on local levels happening. And that sheriff took action, And to come out and compare that incident to his family, there are some little things happening. But these incidents are, I mean, it's not a day goes by that there's not a bunch of them that are happening. But just, you guys, we're into defunding. Let's go straight in. Comments, criticisms, and thoughts. Are you muted, Joe?
John did that to me. I know there was some John. Let me just say that. Let me just say this. I have to take a page from our colleague, Isidore, in that, you know, he keeps, one of his mantras is that, you know, it always comes to an issue of training. And I have to take some disagreeing with that. Every profession has training attached to it. And here's what I mean. Whether you're a doctor, whether you're an educator, whatever you are, funeral director, they have what's called CCEs, continuing college education. So when Izzy says, you know, no matter what, we always come back to training, it is an issue of training, no matter what. Because how do you get better at something? You train. How do you train to how do you respond to an incident? For instance, let's use Uvalde for an example. Most of those guys weren't trained for that type of activity. So it is an issue of training, no matter what you do. Now, there are certain other things, components that go into it. We talk about learning, education. All of them are synonymous. The fact of the matter is that we can only get better when we train better, when we train for it. Military trains all the time for what? So you can respond to that incident. Unfortunately, even though we're a paramilitary organization, all of us across the country, we do not necessarily train to that level that we need to. Hell, police departments are just really getting to the point. Again, here we are in 2020, and we still have problems with race.
Joe?
Sir?
May I jump in for a second?
No.
I'm watching the video, and y'all don't jump on me.
Yep.
I don't see anything so extreme to call for the guy to resign, right? Now, if you talk about, do he need retraining? Do he need time off? Maybe even time off, maybe put him behind the desk for whatever. But she admitted speeding. She continued to drive. Hold on, I got you. I'm going to let you jump on me, Joe. He followed her into a parking lot. At this point, he don't know where she's coming from. Should he have given her an opportunity to explain and accept her? But then he ended up uncuffing her, gave her the citation, and she left.
He had to.
Okay, he could have. I've seen so much shit and so worse that, and these guys are still on board. Some of them got promoted. Mm-hmm. Some of you guys may know some personal stuff where people are now promoted.
Absolutely.
And shouldn't be on the force.
Absolutely.
This right here was something that could have been done. See, the point that I'm getting to, I don't want the pressure of what goes on to blacks and how this gets treated to now become, oh, we're going to be the face of this. We're going to be the ones who set the example. And it's really a minor fraction that the guy committed that he should have been retrained.
Good point.
So that's my only thing is, let's not turn it into, oh, he mistreated this black woman so bad, he should be off the force type thing. And I don't see what he did to cause him to ask to be resigned.
So in the scope of looking at that particular traffic stop, I'll tell you, it's bad. It's bad, 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 bad. Now, that's and the resignation, that's probably not the only one. I'm just, I mean, you're right. You talk about progressive discipline, retraining, things like that in agencies where we have that, right? But we don't have from the news story the history of what else might have been in there. So I'm almost positive the sheriff probably had the file in front of him and was like, you know, I mean, I don't know. I'm just making a guess. I'm just making a judgment guess because, as you said, there are people that have done far worse that, you know, are still there and have been promoted. But I'm hoping and I'm betting that there probably was there's something else there. There's probably something else in his personnel file, disciplinary potentially. I don't know.
From the video, you as a chief, would you ask him to resign?
Yeah, actually, I would have. Because we're not trained for traffic stops are dangerous. I get it, but when and Stan, Joe, you agree, back me up. Say we don't do it this way. But 9 times out of 10, when you're behind a vehicle and you're making a traffic stop, and all of a sudden they start flashing lights and put their hazards on a dark roadway, how many times have we heard? Have we told? If you don't feel safe or you don't think it's really the police, find a well lit area to pull into. So I guess common sense isn't so common because we're telling the officers this. Hey, if somebody does this, this is what they're doing. Now, be cautious, but it doesn't mean we do, you know, jump out the window and, you know, tactical barrel roll or whatever else they try to do. Be cautious and be mindful of it. But I think every – and there could be an incident out there, but every single time that has ever happened to me, and it has happened a lot to me, it is a single female – or female with kids, or somebody that doesn't believe it's the police, and they're calling 911 saying, hey, I'm getting stopped. There's a car behind me. It's got the red and blue lights on. Is that the actually you guys or the police? I've had that multiple times happen. So, you know, you kind of got to know the situation as it is. I mean, if this were a brand new guy, and maybe we would suspend him and retrain him, and I don't know the history of that guy. I don't know if that story said how long he'd served. But that type of behavior is something that's beyond our expectations on a traffic stop.
And you know, that makes sense. And you know, Chief, I think that some of it is training, and we hear the T word come up a lot, training. And you know, by and large, we get a good starter amount of training, and then you learn from incidents that you're actually working. You evaluate yourself. But I've oftentimes said this, and I believe this to be true, which goes along with a lot of the racial profiling and different things that come up, is that I don't think the problem with policing is so big as training, because most of these personal contacts we're having are common courtesy and decent. We learned that as a child before we were even police officers. I think the bigger problem is when we choose to implement the training we've received and to who we choose to implement it to. Some people, we'll go out of our way for them and we'll give them everything of the training, and other people, we just want to get through this call and move on, and we're not going to do it. I watched a deal yesterday where a guy was real polite to the officer, and the officer kept calling him dude. And he said, sir, I'm calling you sir. Why can't you call me dude? And this was in Chicago. And that officer, the guy was a passenger in the car. Just something that simple. That officer could not bring himself to call this grown man sir. Those little things.
Mike, I want to challenge y'all with one question. Had that been a white woman with 3 white kids, and that car would have did the same thing, and the cop would have responded the same way?
Fired.
Yep.
You really believe so?
Yes.
No. For me, yeah. For me, I can't say about that particular sheriff, but for me.
I think sometimes. We get caught up into even the people that want to do the right thing. Sometimes doing the right thing, we get caught up into the media and we buy into all the other shit that goes on around us. I haven't seen, okay, this is kind of like a natural reaction. You got someone speeding. Okay, she looked like she was trying to slow down. She was using a signal, whatever, flashing lights, whatever. Showing the officer, like, I acknowledge you there. And, you know, you guys always talk about adrenaline rush and how that can cause someone's thinking, right? She pulls into the parking lot. We don't have his history to go off. We just have a video. Looking at the video, And there was more things. The guy should have said that. And based on his history, we asked him to resign. But going off what we see here, this to me seems more of retraining or practice, repetitiveness.
John, let me do this real quick.
This is not an everyday thing that happens.
Let me.
Someone keeps driving, pulling into a park lot. This is not an everyday.
You know what? No. On midnights, believe it or not, on midnight shifts, it happens quite a lot because the people don't want to be in the road. They don't want their car hit. It was not unusual for midnight shift officers for that to happen. The person put their hand out the window and wave and point to where they're pulling over.
Yeah.
Or it does happen a lot on midnight shifts. It absolutely does.
Well, let me say this because it's not against down there, but up this way there's more city like type living,
mm-hmm.
less dark roads, maybe that's right.
Banjo's playing.
Joe?
Banjo's playing.
Yeah. Well, that's Joe. That's coming from Joe. But it's less dark, long miles
right.
to deal with. But
John, you talked about the difference of how it would be handled. And we were talking, remember, I was talking about the difference in training and how things are done. Let's watch this right quick. Let me see. Watch this.
A Florida sheriff's deputy has resigned, coming under fire after a traffic stop involving a pregnant woman. The officer following the woman on a dark rural road before she pulled over.
No, not that one. I'm gonna go find this other video because you got to see this other one. But go ahead with your point. I'll find it here in a second. Oh, here we go. Let's see. Because this is gonna kind of stress the point that I was talking about, if I can ever get to it.
Tonight, an Oklahoma woman is in jail after she managed to slip out of her handcuffs in the back of a police car, obtain an AR-15, and open fire on sheriff's deputies, according to local police. The shocking moments were captured on the car's internal camera and police body cams. On Friday, Grady County Sheriff's deputies performed a welfare check on a woman found crawling around someone's yard while barking, according to the charging document filed in court. The woman identified herself as 36-year-old Rachel Zion Clay. Police handcuffed her and placed her in protective custody in the back of a police car, according to the court documents. But while deputies were outside the car taking statements from civilians nearby, Clay managed to slip out of her cuffs and access a console in the front seat labeled gun, the undersheriff said in an interview. They say she was then able to load around into the chamber and fire outside the vehicle. Body camera footage released by police show moments shots ring out. Confusion as deputies try to figure out what just happened.
Hey, I'm here right here.
One civilian receiving a wound to the chest, he's later taken to the hospital, according to NBC affiliate KFOR, while the sheriff's deputy is only grazed by the bullet. As the deputies and the wounded bystander take cover and call for backup, more shots ring out.
What the heck?
Law enforcement expert Cheryl Dorsey weighing in on the incident.
Sometimes women are smaller frame and they have the ability to slip their hands through the cuff, even though the cuff may itself be locked.
With the arrival of backup begins an hours-long standoff as Clay barricades herself in the police car, refusing to emerge. After 3.5 hours of negotiations with police and the deployment of an armored breaching vehicle, the woman finally surrenders.
Okay. That situation right there. They did everything right. All the training was there. And those guys appear calmer than the officer who was out there on the traffic stop, a simple traffic stop.
I don't want to compare the two. I don't. This is terrible to compare the two situations. Now, I got, once again, training. This
mm-hmm.
comes back down to training.
Mm-hmm.
One, you find a lady who was down on all four barking. I didn't see no medical people that should have been there on the scene because obviously there's some mental health.
Training?
I said training.
Mm-hmm.
I said training from the beginning. There should be medical staff there right? I don't understand. Once you identify someone, why do cops keep suspects sitting there? Whoever got the person in their car should have brought them in, into custody. Why do they hold suspects there for 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever the case may be? You got a suspect, you got him cuffed up, take him in, whatever.
No, absolutely not.
Well, this is the reason why you have stuff like this. You have somebody sitting around for a half an hour, and that person ends up slipping out of cuffs. All types of stuff can happen.
Well, I think on that instance, and I go back to training. I mean, we're never supposed to leave somebody in the car by themselves. There's
exactly.
Always somebody there watching them.
Exactly.
So that shouldn't have happened there. And unfortunately, whatever their system is, they've got additional investigation to be done. I guess probably I'm gonna say this is a mental health call. They probably have to get statements because we have to swear or affirm that this person is in duress or a danger to themselves or others or however it may work in that particular area. So the more documentation we have, we have to gather that. They just don't have a choice in doing that. But yeah, they should have had somebody standing there with her, right? I agree on medical too, because especially if somebody's in a mental health situation in the front yard barking. I want an ambulance there because even if it's not mental health, it could be a drug related incident. But going back to the other video, and the point I want to make is you made a point, John, about that adrenaline, right? When somebody's not making that traffic stop, and I wanted to bring this up. I think there's, and I want to say I use it incorrectly, but there's something else going on in that officer's mind to make him to that point. He is way beyond hypervigilant in that situation. So, I hate to comment on it, but I'm guessing that there's probably something else in the history that makes that officer to that level. Because the only thing we can do is compare, when we compare officers as far as behavior and action to what an officer, would they reasonably handle that situation the same way, right? And I don't think anybody would say anywhere that a reasonable officer would handle that situation in that particular incident. I mean, if he stopped and he was worried about the situation, even gone to PA, ma'am, I need, or driver, step out of the vehicle. Once he recognizes what he has, then he can take it back down, right? Mm-hmm. And so, again, that goes back to some of this training and lessons learned.
De-escalation.
From de-escalation, right, instead of going up. I understand 100% what you're saying, because years ago, in my former jurisdiction, I made a traffic stop on a young man, came out of Compton, L.A., right? This was a regular traffic stop for speeding, just as we had with this woman here. I initiated the traffic stop. This guy had his window down on the middle of a state highway, had his key, turned his car off, put his keys in his hands, and stuck his hands out the window. That worried the absolute you-know-what out of me. Because I'm walking up, my traffic stops don't start. They don't start that way. And I walk up and I say, I'm Officer Devlin, I'm a department, go through my 7-step violator. And he's looking at his hands out. I said, why are your hands out? He said, that's where I come from. That's how we do traffic stops.
Yep.
And I said, well, we don't do that here. So you can put your hands back on your steering wheel and we're good. And I told him, that freaks me out. I'm not used to seeing that. And he said, well, that's the way I thought it was done. This is the first time I've ever been stopped in Texas. So, again, depending upon where you're at, that was the late 90s. So depending upon where you were growing up, that's how traffic stops were done. I'm not used to any of that.
But to John's point, I think that let me address the first video. It's interesting because, remember, guys, we just got video cameras in the last, two or three years. So that was a saving grace for everybody. And I'm a proponent of these cameras. But to John's point, look at the way the lady is treated on the traffic stop as opposed to a person that's having a shootout with the police.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you, if they didn't return fire, bothers me to no end.
Mm-hmm. And Joe, there's another thing in there that I didn't play in it, but the officers were aware of everything in our car. How the equipment works, and if you got an AR and you're carrying it in your car, you're putting it in that bracket but they have a actual weapon release button that was not a lock with a key. It was a weapon release button that once anybody pushes it, that AR comes out. That's how she got it. So why would you put this, I'm going back to training, why would you put this woman in the front seat with nobody watching her with an AR?
But I think you guys, this, again, to John's point, you have a black woman on one stop who is totally basically innocent. She's a traffic violator,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to a white woman who's now shooting at the police
mm-hmm.
and then in fire shot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I thought that during the video, too. I don't know how we didn't, once we determined where rounds are coming from, we didn't return fire. I mean, again, if we're being shot at. So that scenario was not, that's not how I would have handled it.
I think you guys should explain to, as well as myself and the listeners. So there's an incident, say like the woman. Okay, so the primary officer, does she go in his car and he gets the report, or do he does the report and he tells another officer to bring her in? Why he gathers the information.
Let me tell you what happened. First off, she's a female, so you've got to call for another female officer. Now, it depends on where you are. There's some places, believe it or not, may not have one on that ship. So that's probably
a lot of places.
Yeah, a lot of places. I know one of them. The other thing is you talk about medical response. Looking at where that place was, ain't no telling how long it took for them to get as a response anyway. But the fact that you were able to get a SWAT unit up and not fire a shot, I just have a problem.
Joe,
yeah, well, so
if you get a call over the radio that someone's in someone's yard on all four parking, the medical response team should have been on his route there anyway.
That's not true. See, there's an assumption. See, there's the problem. We don't know. See, the first one to get the call, 911 police. They don't call 911 fire or 911 mental because there is no mental call. You can't make that assessment until you get there. Yeah, we know she's barking. But again, the first one on the scene, primary officer, has to make that distinction. And even they, if you look at some of these reports, really can't determine if this guy is an athlete, if he, she, or they are just having an episode. We're not, you know, we're trained a certain way.
Making a TikTok video?
Right. I mean, believe that.
And that's it. So to answer your question, Don, it kind of depends. There's not a hard, fast rule on primary officer versus secondary officer doing this or taking this person or that. So in the best case scenario, it would be teamwork. They could figure it out there at the scene, right? But the problem is that there's no medical role, and I don't know what their protocol is in that particular jurisdiction. There's no medical, but somebody should have been on her the entire time, especially if they're going to be sitting in the front seat. And I don't know if that – I couldn't tell her. Look, I know there appears to be a cage.
Yes.
But I don't know if that's the far back cage to the equipment area of the SUV. So, you know, again, I couldn't tell. I'd have to go back and look at the video. But, you know, again, if you're going to have somebody sitting in the front seat, you have to be that much more aware because of the stuff that we have in the car, you know, and even potentially them driving away. You know, so you got to be – so somebody should be on that person as they sit there. But I think before we did anything, as we gather information, in my opinion, is we should have gotten medical when we're out to check this person out, make sure that there's not going to be anything. Because, you know, I'm assuming that it was a mental health call. They were taking her for mental health rather than taking her to the jail. But if it was the jail route, the jail was going to deny them and send her to the hospital anyway. So, you know, again, it just kind of depends where it's at and what the person tells you on the phone. That's another thing. So they call and say, hey, there's a lady laying in my yard. Well, they'll send medical. They're going to send police and medical out there. So, but if somebody calls and says, hey, there's a crazy woman on her walking around barking, that's mostly just going to prompt the police response initially.
And, you know, also, Chief, a lot of people think, you know, you can just toss a female in a car and go to the jail. And this has been long since policy where I was, is that a female officer can transport that female. If not, it's two males. If I got her in my car, there's another officer following me with his video on all the way to the jail. I have to get my starting mileage, when I'm taking off with her and my ending mileage when I get to the jail. So if you don't have a female available, it ties up additional officers if you choose to transport that person. Now, two officers have to go to transport her, two different cars, plus you still have a scene you got to maintain. Are you towing a car? Are you doing so? It's not always as easy as just put them in the car and get them immediately out of there to the jail. And sometimes you have to wait for an ambulance to come. They may say, I took my allergy medicine or I took this. We don't want an in-custody death. So the first thing an officer is going to do is come on that radio. It doesn't matter if they believe the person or not. Start EMT over here. And they'll come check their pulse, check all that. Because you don't want to be going to the jail and then the person vapor locks in the back of your car. Now you got an in-custody death. And it's on your video that they told you they took this medicine or that medicine. So it can become a lot more complicated.
Stan, I see a lot here because dust is one of the big drugs here where people start taking off their clothes and start doing all types of wild, crazy shit. And sometimes the fire department gets there first before the police get there.
Mm-hmm.
And now you see the ambulance coming, you see the police coming, and, but the fire department sometimes get there first. So for me, when I'm looking at this video, and you guys know better than I do, so I don't know how it works, you guys know better, I'm going off sometimes the things that I see, that I see someone bugging off dust, and the first people to arrive on the scene is the fire department, and they're working, and we got to give them some credit, because we never big up the fire department who sometimes arrive to these types of situations. But, I've seen them trying to keep the person calm, cool, relaxed, and whatever.
But because of the anti-police sentiment, John, 18,000 police departments in this country, I'm going to conservatively guess this, 75 to 80% of them are very short. Officers in 12-hour shifts. Call stacked everywhere. You may very well get on a call and there is nobody to back you. And the fire department pretty much is going to come out when there's a fire or a wreck or something like that. So the fact that they get there first doesn't really say a lot because it's not unusual and it's gotten worse since I left. But it was not unusual to hear that dispatcher even sometimes at 2 and 3 in the morning tell one of the sergeants or the commander, hey, we're holding 15 calls. Nobody available. And now it's worse. You got officers in 14-hour shifts, no days off. If you finally get a day off, you're spending it with your family. Your wife's been bitching at you. You're never at home. Then the phone rings. We need you to come in. And you can't say no or you get written up for insubordination. So the manning is hurting so much. You've got places like Dallas that are 700 to 800 officers short. The fire departments aren't short nowhere. Yeah, a lot of times they're going to get there first, but some of it is the police are stretched thin with things we should have nothing to do with, mental health, homelessness. We didn't create homeless. We didn't create mental health. It's not against the law to be homeless. It's not against the law to be a mental health consumer. But what did states do, particularly Texas? They dumped it all on the police. You already don't have enough people to respond to crimes. And we're not going to budget you for that. And a lot of people think police get this extra mental health money and extra homeless assistance money included in their budgets, and it ain't there. So when these officers are spending time, one mental health consumer, one. Suicidal just says, I want to commit suicide because it's raining outside or it's cold or whatever. You deal with this guy every month. I'm giving you an example. You come on your shift at 9, you step out with this person, get called with them at 12. At 7 in the morning, either you're going home or somebody from day shift is now having to come and babysit this guy because they're looking for a hospital bed. They find the bed a day later. Now the police have to put this person in a car and transport them to one of the mental hospitals somewhere in the state of Texas, Austin, El Paso, you don't know where. And that's all overtime, and those officers are gone from the system. They're not, and society doesn't know this. And is there a mental health caveat in the budget for it? Probably not. It comes under overtime. And then they'll come back and say, well, why did y'all have a high overtime rate? Well, we transported 50 people last year to either Austin or El Paso or some of the various other places. And it drains the police budget.
And there are, and again, it's not, it's the mental health issue is not the same across the board, because, you know, where we're at staying is not the same as a resource-rich area like Travis County. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's not even or equitable across the state. And I'm just assuming, because I don't know about mental health services in other states other than things that I've read, I'm pretty sure it's not equitable across those states as well. I mean, that becomes problematic. So when you have, you know, and we'll use Texas as an example, you know, the average size police department in Texas is like two people, to be honest with you. So you have a lot of these small agencies that may be out in the middle of West Texas or somewhere that don't have a whole lot of resources available to them. Certainly not beds, not mental health stuff. And it kind of becomes, you know, a system where we deal with folks, we take them, we get them the attempt to get them the help that they need from the mental health professionals, and then, you know, tell me I'm wrong, we're out there next month dealing with it. So, I mean, it's cyclical, and there's not a whole lot of follow-up with the mental health concern because there's not a whole lot of resources that are available. Now, we're finding and we're borrowing from other entities, right, that are around us that have come up with good programs, and we've been able to help, you know, are able to bring some of the resources that they have in to help agencies like mine. And so that's alleviating a little bit, but it's still, again, we'll sit on a mental health consumer for 6, 7, 8 hours before they get treatment. And again, Texas is a big place. And if you're driving from central Texas to El Paso, that's a long drive. That's a very long drive. And I know of
11 hours one way.
I know one particular situation from an agency that's close to me that had to do it because that was the only bed that was available in the state of Texas, everywhere. Now, I'm talking in all of Texas. We've even had them that I know of where we've driven them to just on the other side of the border in Louisiana because that was the only mental health bed that was available. So, you know, I hate that they drop that down on law enforcement, and that's something that we have to deal with on a consistent basis. I think they need to get their act together. Legislators need to get their act together and really truly fund this and build this program back up because it's mental health is an epidemic. We deal with it every single day. And so, you know, we need to treat it that way. We need to put the resources that are available to get people the help that they need.
And take it away from us, because right now police officers are stressed out across this country. So you're sending a potential mental health consumer to deal with the mental health consumer. And I don't know, Chief, you would know better than I do. I would like to see more than just a 10-hour class in the academy on mental health. No, we're not going to be psychiatrists, psychologists when we come out. But I don't think there's enough emphasis put on training for as far as, you know, dealing with mental health consumers, because de-escalation isn't being practiced as much as it should be. We're dealing with regular calls. I'd like to see more training put in, but I'd like to see when these people are yelling defund the police, why don't you get a copy of your police budget and see where this money is actually going? Then get a copy of the call sheet and find out the things the police are always tied up going to. I left my garage door open. Can you have an officer go check? Actual call. My kids won't get up and go to school. Can you send a police officer? Actual call. But if the department's policy is we go to every call for service, that's unrealistic. And you're working your patrol officers into the dirt with that.
Yeah, I think there needs to be enhanced mental health training. And I think that, the state, Texas is doing a fair job. I know there's other states that are pushing more advanced training on mental health, you know, but that's for our interactions and dealing. I agree that, you know, I'm never going to be a psychologist. I'm never going to be able to, you know, delve into that level with a mental health consumer. And I don't need to be at that level. That's not my job. I shouldn't have to do that.
Exactly.
I should be able to intervene with the mental health issue, recognize what it is, and then get them the direction that they need to go. That should be the dealing of law enforcement if that's the requirement. And to get rid of it completely for us, it's not going to happen because simply how the call comes in, right? There we have probably a mental health call in the video, and who is it that responds? The police. Because they're going to say, there's somebody in my yard barking. Well, they're going to send the police because that dispatcher doesn't recognize that as a mental health call. Now, there are agencies across the country that are getting better with that. right? More questioning at the answering point when that call comes in, right? Beyond just, oh, okay, somebody parking the yard, dispatching units. They start delving a little bit further into it. There are dispatch centers that have mental health trained professionals in them and crisis lines where they can divert a lot of this stuff. And I think that's a very novel idea. I don't know the outcome. Like, I don't know how many diversions for law enforcement that occurred. I'm sure those numbers will come out at some point in time. But I'm very interested in that. What does that keep the officers from having to go to and actually respond to law enforcement-related calls? I think that's a pretty novel concept, if it works and it's in place. But again, that's people. That's a vision and a goal that an agency has to have, or a community. Actually, it's really a community that has to be behind that to put that into place. And I think there's some value to it. I'm waiting to see how that all works out. And was it good to do that? And that's down in Austin that they're doing that. So I'm interested to see how that's going to unfold and unravel for them down there. And if it does, maybe that's something that, you know, other agencies need to start looking at. Dallas has a program themselves where they have an officer, a paramedic, and a mental health professional in a vehicle funded by the hospitals to respond to these calls and do follow-ups. And I think that's a great concept. I think that's a great idea, but the city has to be behind that. The people have to be behind that in order for that to happen. So there's some really great ideas that are taking place. I think we're, you know, there's not a one size fits all. And so you take what agencies have and you try to make it fit. It's almost like community policing. You can't say that you need to do this and this is how this is going to work, because it's not going to fit in every community. It just isn't going to work. You have to design it for your community itself. But I think we're moving, not as fast as I'd like to, but I think we're moving forward in that realm and how as law enforcement professionals we're dealing with those particular incidents.
You said something, I have to jump in real quick. The number one killer of police officers are the domestic violence calls. How many of those calls come out to be mental health issues? How many of our officers have been shot? Because, and again, go addressing the issue of how the calls come out. And you'd be surprised what the numbers look like.
No, I agree. And you know, you can only take the information that you get. All right. I mean, you know, I run in my own, we'll call it PSAP here in Texas, basically it's a dispatch center. And so, you know, the information coming in is only as good as the information, you know, that's given. So, I mean, you've got to be mindful and start thinking about these things. So on the other side of that, you know, we need to tell our officers and supervisors when this call comes out and it's the barking lady in the front yard. Okay. What am I looking at? What am I thinking about? Right. And going beyond just somebody in the yard barking. All right. Well, how are we going to respond? Let's put an action plan into place as we respond. Is this mental health? Is it narcotics related? Right. Because those are the first two that pop in your mind. Right. And then when you show up and it's somebody making a TikTok video, well, then, you know, again, I agree, Joe, that information that comes in kind of dictates how it all gets sent out. So.
And you know, Chief, it happens more than people would think. A lot of times what you're being told over that radio and what that caller is telling dispatch, it's not what's going on. They just want to get an officer there. I've been to those calls. My ex-boyfriend is here, and he's got a gun. Do you see it? Well, I think he's got it. Because you mentioned gun, it gets us there quicker.
Yes.
And sometimes people will look at how the officer reacted when he or she got there. Nobody ever goes back and looks at the call. Because a lot of times people will say, particularly on midnights, it's all I can talk about, they'll say whatever they think they can say that's going to get the officer there first, especially when we're holding calls. And they know it might be 30 minutes before an officer gets there. Oh, I think he's got a gun. Or, oh, he threatened to kill me. So now that call gets prioritized higher. So now you're leaving from something you were going to, and you're going there because we have to do it. So a lot of times what citizens will tell you, well, I told the police this and that, and we'll look at the video and say, well, the police knew this. Go look at the call notes. Go listen to the phone call. You're going to find out that's not what they said, because there are a lot of parents out there.
Well, I was going to say, don't do that. Just give me for the state, don't do that, because there are jurisdictions that will arrest you for false reporting for doing that. So I'm just throwing that out there. So we're not advocating to do that. Please do not do that. Tell us the information that's true and correct. Don't lie, because it's not going to make us, if we have to break off something else and you told us a lie in order to get us there faster, that's a false report. That's a criminal offense. Don't do that.
And you get there and they want to scream and holler because you're pointing a gun at somebody. When this is the very same person sometime on the phone, they told the dispatcher the guy's got a gun and threatened to kill him.
The point that I was going to make was, I think Chief kind of touched on it, but a lot of departments don't hold the people accountable for making those type of reports, and that's the problem. When you got someone,
let me just stop you. That's not the department's job to hold people accountable for false reports. That's the prosecutor.
Well, I mean, the police got to take the first step to that.
That's right. They got to do an offense report.
I think they got to do a report. They got to, even if they do an arrest or whatever, the police got to take the first step in that. You just don't pick up the phone, call the prosecutor and say, hey, I had a guy who gave a false report the other day. Mm-hmm. They have to be steps made by the police.
Okay.
I'm just saying, because as you guys all acknowledge, it happens on a regular basis to get the cops here. I went to part of my house. Let me call the police and say this, and he threatened me this. And then none of it ever happened.
That's right.
The cops come there, they come, all types of guns and stuff, and then the dude said, man, I'm grabbing my stuff, man. She tried to stop me from leaving, and it was nothing what she said it was.
Right.
And meanwhile, she goes back in the house, and I'm not picking on women, but it happens a lot with ladies. And nothing happens.
I agree, and I think law enforcement needs to call a lot of that. They need to do the report. I can't do anything about the prosecution of those individuals. I can certainly, because it's in our state, it's an on-view offense, I can go ahead and make the arrest, because it's information I've investigated and found to not be true. But as far as that upper level, I get what you're saying, John, as far as accountability, the officers are not doing reports, they're not making arrests as a result of it, and they should, absolutely 100% should. They don't get prosecuted, that's it, where Joe's talking about that level that's beyond us, so... Yeah, I agree. I think those folks need to be held accountable when they do that type of stuff, because they're wasting resources, and even more important, they're putting people's lives at risk when they do stuff like that. I mean, how many videos have we seen where somebody says this? I mean, and the officers show up, and because of the nature of the call, they're aggressive as a result, and that's not it. And you have exactly what you said, somebody like, hey, man, I'm just walking my dog. Why do you guys all got your guns on me? Well, that's because this person called and said that you did that. That's a crime. We need to hold that person accountable. I agree. Sorry.
And here it is. Stan just called, someone got a gun and this and that. He's going through life. He gets there, find out none of this shit is true, right? Now, even if the prosecutor said, well, we're going to give that person 3 hours community service, nobody wants to have their life disturbed. I watch soaps at this time, and now I got to go do 3 hours. They're going to stop that bullshit. Nobody wants someone telling them what to do with their life for a certain amount of hours, so they're going to stop that shit. But it starts with the police holding them accountable. And all of y'all can answer this. How many times you went there and said, ma'am, your story's not making sense. He's saying this. I'm asking you. I'm giving you an opportunity to tell the truth, or I'm going to have to bring both of you in if she tells you the truth.
You know, and and a lot of times, though, that is not the beat officer. I want to make that distinction, because society just thinks the beat officers show up and do what they want to do, and everything just magically happens. And it's not true. In a lot of places, you got to inform that supervisor, that sergeant, of what you got going on. And if the sergeant's worth their pay, they're going to go by there to see what's going on. And a lot of times officers are upset when they come up to a house with their guns out and these things, and what was being told is not what happened. They are upset. When we're amongst ourselves talking about it, they're pissed off because they could have killed somebody. They could have been sued. Yep. Everything's going through their head. And when you say, Sarge, I wouldn't charge this lady with false report. Well, no, we don't. The department doesn't really want to do that. That street officer can't do anything at that point. He or she can't. You know, and that person gets to get away with it. No, they can't. There are, you know, I've seen, John, I had a lady, as God is my witness, at least 20 to 30 calls a week on, I'm seeing witches on brooms. A UFO landed in my backyard. I had to keep going to those calls, keep going to them. I could have been, there's other things to do. But the department policy was, we go, unless the sergeant canceled it, sometimes they did. But these are the frustrations the street officers have when they know there's a problem area that, okay, it's 11:30, I really need to be in this part of town or my beat to do something, but they can't because they have these other calls that they have to go to.
And you say, you know what I have, the problem I have with a lot of this shit, right? And I apologize to everybody because I've been using profanity today because I had a rough week, and you guys know about it. But the problem I have with a lot of stuff is when a supervisor tells an officer to do something wrong, illegal, that they freaking know is illegal, majority of the time they freaking do it. They can investigate somebody illegally. They can arrest somebody illegally, shake somebody down illegally, do all the stuff that they know is illegal, right?
Mm-hmm.
But when a supervisor tell you to, don't arrest them, but you know that is a violation of the law, I don't know. It's frustrating to hear because there's cops who have done things that they know is against the law and they shouldn't be doing it because they fall on the supervisor. And then here you got on the other hand when you know the law is in the cop's favor, even over the supervisor, you mean to tell me you're just going to ignore the law because the supervisor? That should be.
John, and what you just tapped into is the subculture within patrol. I'm only talking about street officers. If you got three different shifts, say you got three squads on each shift, your day shift, your afternoon, your midnight shift, don't think officers don't talk. We do. There are some sergeants everybody wants to work for because you might not like him, but he's fair, he's consistent, you always know where you stand. There are some supervisors who have their good old boys that they'll take care of and the hell with everybody else. And then you have some that are just going to treat everybody like crap. And you'll find each year when we bid for our shifts, you'll see a multitude of officers that want to leave certain supervisors and go work for another one. And so the officers see it. But when you're in this police culture, when you start speaking up about something, you're going to pay the piper. One way or another, you're going to pay. It's not fair, but it is the way it is. That's why we have these things called whistleblowers, and it's just a fact. When you start calling out things and speaking up, you become the bad person, the rebel rouser. And you're right. And there's officers who feel just like you feel, but where are they going to go?
Yeah, that's a cultural issue within an agency, an ethical issue, an integrity issue. When we start talking about supervisors, especially, and again, I'm not going to pretend that that doesn't happen because we know illegal shakedowns and things like that in departments do occur because we've seen it. But then, I'm going to put it back on a supervisory issue from that supervisor. You know what I mean? So when you're running an organization, if it's a true organization the way it is, and some places are they have too many officers and too little supervisors, right? And so you don't have the checks and balances. And as I, what I'm just saying is like on a particular shift, two, like a lieutenant, a sergeant, and let's say five officers is swapped. Right. So that check back on what everybody's doing. And again, it's different from place to place. But as a smaller agency, it's much easier for me, and simply because, I hear what's going on. So the check backs, when I hear something and I say, well, why did we do A, B, and C? Well, then I get an immediate answer. It's not like that everywhere. And I hate that for agencies, because that's what ends up happening is you have stuff like that occur. And it gets pushed off and washed away, and nobody knows about it. So, there are ways to combat that, but it's having the good right people there and holding those people accountable for making the correct decisions. The only time I think a supervisor should say we're not going to make the arrest is if it's not an arrestable offense or the officer messed up, right? And that goes back to discretion, right? And, you know, so we got to be mindful of a lot of that stuff. You know, we don't need to be heavy-handed on, you know, Class C violation, but let somebody walk on a felony. You know, so I mean, there should be more input by the supervisors and administrators need to make sure their supervisors are supervising, and that gets lost. I mean, in an agency like where Joe worked, I can almost assure you it gets lost because they get pulled 500 different directions, and they don't have the ability to do that. Like where, and I think to me, it makes more of an impact in an organization when you have that ability to do that. So I don't know the answer for many large departments, but I think sometimes if they could scale some of those squads and platoons down, it may make life a little bit easier, and you can get eyes on what's happening. And when you have things that shouldn't be done, you can address those, hold those people accountable, and get rid of them if need be. Just my two cents on that.
Doesn't that mean then, in my Lilliputian mind, that more direction or more focus on the ethical issue could be raised? I mean, if you read these DOJ findings, every one of them talks about, everyone said two things. Again, they talk about the racism in the department. They also talk about the manpower issues, the supervision, too much, not enough direct supervision. And the first line supervision is what? Sergeants. So they're saying there's not enough sergeants. It's kind of like the old adage, I hate to use it, too many chiefs and not enough Indians. And that's what you have, because now you're just addition, you're really addressing issues of ethics and oversight and accountability. Mm-hmm. At least that's my mind.
No, I agree. I agree, because that's where I pull that from, because you always see that when they go in and these departments have these problems. There's not a direct line of people watching over, and you have, you know, 25 line officers and one sergeant. You know, how do you manage that? Those need to be my piece that needs to be broken down into smaller units, more supervisors, direct supervisors, and not 25, but you're breaking down into, you know, 10 and 5. However you want to do it, however you want to break that down. But there has to be somebody in charge of those five people. Then therefore you have that direct line, decision-making is there, you're hearing what's going on, they're going to these calls, how they're responding, they go to do the calls, they don't sit in an office, you know, drinking coffee, but they're out actually being a first-line supervisor, and that's important. It's the toughest job in any law enforcement organization is that first-line supervisor, sergeant, and I'll never take that position away. It was tough, but if you do it right, you can then bring people up to take your position in the future when you're doing it the correct way. So I do not disagree with you there at all, Joe.
Hey John, you said you wanted to bring a point up.
Yes. I think it would be irresponsible of us to not talk about, since we're talking about copycats and earlier, and there's going to be things like the Buffalo shooting and stuff. Bear in mind that our children and grandchildren are going back to school, and we must also discuss about keeping them safe. And it's something that's been, like, really on my mind, and it's probably dear to the chief because I know his wife is a teacher, if I recall correctly. So I was thinking about having the camera systems set up in the schools, and people probably say, well, it's so expensive, but we need to look at how much money is spent into the Department of Corrections monitoring system, right? Now, they have monitors that monitor so that guys can't escape, but you know what most of that stuff is? Most of the cameras and security stuff they have, they spend more money keeping inmates safe from other inmates. But they don't want to spend the money to keep your children safe. And that's what we need to talk about, where some of this money can go. Instead of, you know, I'm not saying because these guys, and trust me, I did 24 and a half years here. I'm not saying that these guys shouldn't be protected. It's like they got cameras that can zoom into the cell and watch everything, but it's for the inmate safety from attacks from other inmates and guards and rapes and stuff like that. But we spend so much freaking money into protecting these people who put themselves there in most cases, but we don't want to spend that type of money on protecting our school.
And John, we can,
they're not a camera system set up in this public school system.
You know what? And we can even roll it back out of the jails into the civilian populace because we got cameras set up in red light to catch speeders so we can write tickets and make money. We've got cameras where we can watch the highways, and the video footage comes back sometimes if we got a major wreck. It's good evidence. But if we can send cameras out there that can watch the highways and they can watch, you know, the red lights, why aren't there cameras at the schools? And I'd go one step further. If you had cameras on the outside to look at the school grounds, you've got a school district channel. Have it viewable. Maybe if they knew the parents sometime would be looking at the school channel, oh, my kid goes to school there, let me see what's going on, and the camera's just, you know, pan around the outside of the school. You never know what somebody's going to see. And I, you know, when people start talking about the cost, that's that bullshit that comes up, because if we can patrol a red light 24 hours a day on the off chance that today somebody's going to run it and we get to write a $200 ticket and that justifies his camera, or we can tune in and watch the highway, watch Interstate 35 in three or four different locations, why can't we see the schools from our laptops? Even if you don't want to open it up and make it public to the community to see, you can set it up to where that officer, I come to work, you know, night or day, I've got three schools in my beat. I should be able to access that application and pull up all three of my schools and look at them day or night on the outside of that perimeter.
Sam, check out what you just said, right? Now imagine if, okay, you got, okay, there's an officer that's working in school, right? And then if you had a camera system, and let's just say, God forbid, there's an active shooter in there. If you had a camera system set up, when the SWAT team arrived, their guy could go in and say, okay, he's situated here on the east, on this room. He can tell them exactly where he is.
And what he looks like.
We sit back and talk about, mm-hmm. Oh, they shot outside because they didn't know where he was at. They didn't know what he had. They didn't know if he's still alive. They didn't. Okay, but if you had a camera system that showed you where you can zoom into the classroom, okay, he's in classroom 302. He's on the, he's behind the desk on the left.
So, John, let's issue a challenge there.
Let's issue
a challenge real quick. I'm going to throw this out to the school districts and the city. Why don't you enter a partnership? You got IT people there who are big brain computer children. Enter into an agreement and do a little finding or examination and see what something like that would cost to implement just in a few areas. And have the officers be able to click on an app in their car and look at the outside of that school. And then pay for that with your red light cameras.
Chief, be quiet, Chief.
Yeah, no, I was just letting Sam finish up, and you're right, and I'm gonna take it a couple steps further, and I'm gonna try to not give away kind of what I got going on in my area, but it's about those organizations coming together. Sam just said it, school district, city coming together to get that stuff done. Cameras are a piece of the puzzle, mm-hmm. because if you go back and you look, remember we all saw you, Valley. That told them where it was at, but it takes somebody to go deal with that, right? And that's all I'll say about that. But that's a piece of the puzzle. But building the relationships, and you said at the beginning, my wife is an educator in the city that I work in. And so I take the schools in a certain level, different level. I mean, and not just her campus, but all the campuses. I mean, those are the most vulnerable people that we have in our community next to elderly folks. So we've got to put a lot of momentum in dealing with that. We have always had good relationships, and it has blossomed into allowing that, exactly what the two of you are talking about, access, right? Mm-hmm. But that's relationship building, right? And that's getting the powers that be together to allow that stuff to come on the same level and say, this is the mission, this is what we're trying to do, this is what we're trying to prevent, this is how this is going to help us in the future and in the long run. To me, it's a simple concept because I've had that in place for probably about 7 years now. So if we don't have 8 places that are doing that, they need to get off the ball and get moving, right? And they have to put that measure of protection into the campuses to protect those individuals during that particular school year, right? Continual checks at the schools, right? And I'm not just talking about school resource officers. I'm talking about patrol officers. If they have the ability to do it, again, I get it, a lot of busy places. And they're call to call, so there's not a whole lot of downtime for them folks. But you need to make it a priority of the organization that these are the places that we need to be, right? Mm-hmm. And there are many ways around it. I'm not even going to get into all the technical or you know, financial, because districts have money too. And I think if you look at the school districts themselves, some of them do pretty well, right? There are others that don't. And if they don't have that funding mechanism to put that stuff in there like a camera, then we need to figure out how to get that in place, and we need to help those individuals get that type of, whether it's grant money from the government or whatever it may be, help those individuals get that type of stuff to put it into their facilities. Again, it's a multi-pronged approach on how you deal with those particulars, but you have to make that a priority, a top priority of an organization. I don't disagree with you, John. That is a novel concept, and I hate that you had to bring it up from the Department of Corrections, but it's true. They monitor you guys to keep you guys safe. That's what they do. And so it's not to keep you from getting out. I mean, that's just a video of you escaping if you were to escape, but it's to monitor that population. And it can be done. It's not a Department of Corrections idea that you put cameras in a school. It's just an overwatch, right? It's an overwatch of children to make sure that there are no instances that are taking place within inside that particular building. So that's a great concept. I don't know about, you know, where you guys are at, how that works within your particular school districts. I'd be interested to know, but there's a significant focus in our state in order to do that. And a lot of districts are, and by law from the state, are having to implement these things and changes and door checks. And, you know, so there's a lot of stuff that's been put on them that I don't disagree should have been done many years ago, but we're helping assist them getting that stuff just to keep that population safe. So yeah, I'm 100% proponent behind that, but I'm going to tell you, from having to do that, it comes down to that relationship building, because you got two completely separate entities.
Yep.
That traditionally don't work with each other.
Politicians.
So you've got to lay down that groundwork, and it's not a you know, a couple day process. It's a multi-year process of getting with those individuals, superintendents, the people that are in charge, and talking back and forth. I mean, I personally probably speak to our school superintendent, and we're in Texas. It's a 6A district. I don't know how they classify most districts. The 6A district is the biggest district you can be in, and so I talk with the superintendent often. We meet often in order to you know, talk about problems and things that may occur in our world, and I try to assist them. You know, again, the thought process from a law enforcement agency and an education agency, they normally don't cross paths. They do now. So we've got to be all on that same page in order to efficiently respond and protect that vulnerable community when it comes down to, you know, one of these people committing this heinous act.
What do you think, Joe? City decides, is that practical? Do you think it would work?
Well, to John's point, we protect prisoners as opposed to our most vulnerable population. I think it's right on the money. Can it work? Certainly. I think, at least in my mind, again, we go back to the real crux of all this, manpower. Because you still got to have someone to man those issues. Now, Chicago at one time had what was called a school unit. Again, robbing Peter to pay Paul, They then disbanded that unit and then gave that function back to the district. So now you took, now you're taking manpower out of the district to do what you had a specializing unit do. So now you're, again, taking or tasking a unit. You're looking good on paper, but you're not doing, you're not solving the problem. But if the issue is safety, then John and Chief are correct. We have, it has to be done. If we're going to, again, it goes back to another thing. If we're going to talk about police reform, that's got to be part of the reform package.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who are we protecting?
Let me grab a caller real quick. 352 area code's been holding. 1650. Good morning.
Good morning, Sam. How you doing? It's Pastor Don Jean, CEO. I'm happy to be back on, Brian. Now, I'm happy to be back on the radio with you, bro. It's been a minute, a long minute.
Yeah, we're doing good.
Hey, man, well, can I chime in on the topic?
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I really...
Still there? Your phone's cutting out.
And with the people who's out there doing dirt, police don't have enough interaction with the people who's actually living.
Yeah, Pastor Don.
They were out in communication, at least speculation.
Your phone's cutting out. We're only getting like three or four words. You there? Okay, he dropped. You'll probably have to call back because I couldn't get the gist of what he was saying. But go ahead, John. John, you had a point you were about to make before I went to the caller?
Yeah, I could have lost.
Yeah, you did. You had this look like...
The caller stole my thunder, man. What did I say? No, it was something that Joe said, man. And it's about... Oh, this is what it was. So the same way that you have a dispatch center, you hire three officers to monitor, and when you really think about it, these three officers would be monitors just for the school year. So you don't have to pay additional money. You take them, you put them in the same place as the dispatch center. These three officers could, this officer could watch over these schools over here. These cameras here, he's watching over these schools. He's watching, and it takes three to four officers.
But, John, not officers, civilians. Officers don't need to be behind a desk because we don't have enough on the street. I agree, but dispatchers are civilians. Hire, let's take your same scenario, but make them civilians, not officers.
Okay, but they would definitely need some serious training because this is vital information. Like, you could see, they have to be able to recognize certain things and get that information to the dispatcher right away. And the reason why I say officers, because if you had a trained officer, hear what I'm saying, Sam, he's there in that dispatch center telling them exactly where the shooter is, what he's doing. There has to be at least one officer on the scene of that dispatch center.
Believe it or not, those men and women in dispatch, those civilians, do an excellent job. Better most times than most officers.
Okay.
And they do
okay.
it by the front.
I'm going to challenge you on that.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, black male wearing black pants and black shirt.
Mm-hmm.
Stan Mason gets stopped. Joe Mosley gets stopped. And John Ruffin gets stopped.
Mm-hmm.
And we all three different complexions.
Yep.
They do a funny job, Stan. They do a
why not? Why I get stopped?
Well, you don't get stuck in years.
No.
You didn't get a tan this summer.
But, John, what I'm saying is you're comparing a phone call to a video. And I'm saying this, to me, those dispatchers do an excellent job. If you ever got a chance to listen to some of those calls, the thing is, we cannot, and I was getting ready to say it before you said this, we need to get all these police officers out from behind desks anyway and get their ass back in a car because some departments have too many officers sitting around with coffee breaks and lunch breaks, sitting behind a desk pushing paper. They're not detectives. They're administrative assistants. We can't say we don't have enough officers on the street, and we got officers riding desks. If a civilian can do that job, create the position, employ a citizen, and stick them in there.
So let me ask any one of you guys. Do any one of you guys feel safe with your fellow officers going into a school with an active shooter and you got civilians? Do you feel safe with your children being in that school and you got an active shooter and you got a civilian telling the SWAT team or telling the cops where this guy is?
I absolutely do. Because we go to calls every day that aren't active shooter calls that are potentially dangerous. And guess what? There's a man or a woman, a civilian, at the other end of that radio giving us information.
Stan, when leading a tactical squad into a line of fire to try to save people's lives, are you confident in a civilian doing it?
Yep.
Or are you more comfortable with a trained officer?
Are you talking about the UTOT? Are you talking about
having one trained officer inside a dispatch center that watching the school, the monitors? You got
I'll just say, John, and I don't know, your city and Joe, and actually we're talking civilians. Actually, the dispatchers now are actually a certified position. Mm-hmm. They hold a license, so the same as the officers. But to answer your question, my simple answer is yes. And the reason why I say yes is because those people that will take that call have been trained to deal with that particular situation. In my area, because there's actually a telecommunicators course for active shooting, and they all go through it, and so they have that particular training. So when you talk about the training, in going in that situation like that, you bring the whole package together. You bring the telecommunicator, you bring the officers, you bring the school in there, right? So you have those entities as we respond, teachers, kids, role players, and so that's how that response goes. So you practice to go in and deal with those particular situations. So I can't speak for other states. I'm hoping that they have something along those lines, but that is, your point is 100% correct. Now if I had an officer I want the officer to respond, because I need that person there to deal with that's my thought process. Now if they were light duty or couldn't, they weren't able to work the street for whatever reason, then that would be an appropriate place for that person to go to help give direction. Because you got to understand, when one of those heinous acts takes place, it takes a lot of people. And so that dispatch center is then going to go into a different mode. And the more eyes and people I have in there, the better it is going to be for us. So I understand what you're saying, and I wish we could all do that. But realistically, if you're a licensed officer and you're carrying a gun, I need you coming to that scene, because there's gonna be a lot of work to be done, and I need those people there.
But John,
real quick, I appreciate what you just said. Certified people, civilians. However, that civilian also needs to be certified with at least training, some training with SWAT and the school department. It has to be like a collective training together, and to keep them active. And
John, my former department actually did that. My former department actually did that. There are some training classes we would go to, and there would be dispatchers actually sitting in there getting what we got. I got to give them credit there. You would have detectives in there. You'd have officers in there. You'd have dispatchers. Yeah, they would actually come down and sit in those classes.
Just real quick, Joe, before you go, but I was just saying that your point is well taken, John, because that's like me grabbing you and going to the dispatch center and say, here, answer these phones. Mm-hmm. If you don't train them how to do it, then you're never going to know how to do it. So from the expectation from an administrator, we need that person dialed in when we're going. They have to have trained in to do that. I can't expect somebody who's never done that before to perform at the level we need them to perform at if they've never done it before. So, again, I appreciate that, but I think that's – when we start talking about training and any training, that's a component that is often left out. There's usually some folks that are left out that don't get involved, and then we ask them to do stuff that they're not technically trained for, nor have they practiced before. Sorry, Joe. Go ahead.
Let me just give you this. In my ideal department, I would create three positions, tier one, tier and two, tier one, tier two, tier three. Tier one would be a dispatch. Tier two, this is one where I want everybody to listen very closely. Tier two would be retired police officers. Tier three would be active police officers. I would take the tier one employees. Everyone has to be cross-trained. But the tier two employee, the retirees, is the most underutilized in this country. We're talking about we could have a reactionary force. I think the last number I saw was over 100,000. 100,000 trained officers that could be put back or utilized at some point. You've got to train them. They're there. But because this country is so run afoul and we're not willing to look at or think outside the box, you see what's happening. Because of the tier two employee, the retiree, could also be your retention. They could be your recruiter. If you want to bring people back to the job, find somebody that's done it, that has an experience that can give it out and say, look, this is why we did this. This is what it should be. And if we took that, we wouldn't have the exacerbation of the patrolmen being decimated at this point.
Mm-hmm.
100,000. Not right now.
No, I agree, because I think there's some functions in law enforcement that can be pushed off on folks like that, right, that take it off the line patrol officer, like, you know, simple, just like reports, just a paper taken call, you know, no action, there's no suspect, there's nobody there, my car got broken into 2 days ago.
Mm-hmm.
But that function can be pushed off of the actual responding officer who would actually go to law enforcement calls that are taking place. I think it's a novel concept. I have actually had this idea and brought it up in my community about public safety officers, PSOs. I stole it. It is not my idea. But some of the lower level stuff, and you train them in some crime scene stuff, and they can go out and they can take prints. They can do some minor crime scene stuff. They can help with traffic direction. They can do a lot of this stuff. So there are officers that are still available to answer calls for service, but you can actually recruit from that position, because it will be open for individuals that were, you know, 18, 19 years of age. They learn the culture of the department, right? They come in, they can write reports, and then they pass the testing metric, whatever it is for that organization, and then they can get sent to the academy. So you're recruiting from your own community.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea of the retirees, as long as they're not the jaded retirees that are just like, I'm done with all this stuff. And when I do know, and yeah, and I do, yeah, and I know a lot of them that are, hey, I've done 33 years.
So are you looking for
done?
No.
hey, Chief, let me ask you, with your idea, just there locally, with 35 in the traffic, imagine if they tapped into these retired officers and they came out, even if they did nothing else, just a typical Central Texas day, if they worked traffic accidents, that would free patrol officers up immensely.
It absolutely would. I mean, and then there's a whole other component on the side of it where you have what they call a COPS program. I know you're familiar with civilians on patrol. They put them in a car. It doesn't say police, it says citizens on patrol or civilians on patrol, however they brand it, and they roll around the community. They drive around. They're a whole other community policing aspect. They go out and they talk to people, they report suspicious behavior, they don't get out and, you know, start chasing people, right? We put them riding around in shopping centers, you know, and looking for people breaking into cars, stuff like that. And, you know, it's a volunteer program, but you cultivate those people from, again, community policing, citizens police academies, and functions that take place within the community. So again, you have this well-rounded, but the officer, the retired officer, depending upon your state, you know, Texas, you can still come back out of service as a retiree. You still just have to keep up with your continuing education credit hours, right? And then you can basically get your license back. And so it's a novel concept to bring those individuals that want to still continue to do the job. Or in that type of program. I mean, hell, even volunteer, having a retiree come in and volunteer and work the front desk, right, could alleviate and or allow a line officer to get back out on the street or to become a detective or whatever. You know, so you got to think about that concept.
think about it, again, if we use the idea of the tiers 1, 2, and 3, that tier 2 employee or retiree could be moved because he or she has been trained. It could be moved to whatever functions you wanted. And particularly when we talk community policing, we blow community policing out the water with the right people.
And Joe, and to your point, one of the things that's sorely lacking in policing right now is over the last 3 years. The drought of experience of officers who have walked out, there's basically been a experience vacuum. The supervisors are a lot younger, and it's not to say that they're not good, all of them, but they don't have those years of experience. So you've got a big experience vacuum right now in policing, and they're promoting younger guys, and that's fine and good. But, you know, so, yeah, that would help out a lot if you bring the guys with experience back to some degree, to be able to say, well, you know, hey, let's try doing it this way or let's handle it this way. And they have a reputation generally and get along with the public a lot better than your newer officers who are trying to find their niche in the community.
Just an idea, gentlemen, just an idea.
Yeah. No, I think it's a novel concept. I know that there's been talk about that. About bringing retirees back into the service and providing stuff. Not everybody wants to do it. I mean, you know, I know there are some, but we got to be realistic because there's some, like I said, that do the 33 and they're like,
you don't want
to go on vacation. You know,
you didn't have these guys retire.
yeah. So, but you still can cultivate. I think it's a novel concept. It's a good idea. And then if you add it into the, you know, the PSO and then the COPS program, I think. Man, that's well-rounded, and you hit a lot of areas within a community based on what the community wants, and you're able to you know, deal with multitudes of issues and keep officers to respond to legitimate calls.
Well, we're at that 20-minute mark. Let's go around and get some final thoughts because I know John's got a breakout. We want to make sure we get the final thoughts in. Big John?
Yes, man. I want to thank everybody for a great show, man. This is a great topic. Mind it, relax. I want to apologize to everybody for me using a little profanity. Today is unbecoming of me, the new me. Just had a rough week with one of my sons who I put so much into, and I want to share this with people because you know, even if it's your own kid, man, sometimes you got to wash your hands of them and try to direct them and use your life as an example. But when they want to engage with the streets, you know, sometimes, and as much as it hurt me as a father to say this, you know, my son was in trouble, and instead of facing it, he decided to become a fugitive from justice. He had a bracelet on his ankle. He cut it off. And as a father, I can't support that. And I tried speaking to him. He told me that he was going to turn himself in, and he lied to me. So at this point, it ain't about the money that was put up for his bond, which was $650,000. He just disregarded everybody because the danger in what he has done, because he's a registered gun offender in our state. He recently was caught with 13 guns, 14 extended clips. And I'm saying this because I want people to understand the magnitude of stuff. He had a round clip that held however many shots. So when the police come to his house, I'm not going to be the father to say they shouldn't have came there like that. I understand why. I've watched enough shows, enough clips on this show. It's been talked about enough on this show to understand why they came like that. The problem that I'm having is that my freaking son don't have enough respect and care that now they can go to any of his kids' mothers, his mother house, my house looking for him. And God forbid his 12-year-old son, who stands 6'1", 6'2", they confuse him in a no-knock warrant for his arrest, search warrant. Something happens. So I can't support my son. So that's all the frustration coming out of me using profanity. I guess we got to do a disclaimer because of the stuff I just said, but just tough. It's just tough. But it's great to have brothers who hold me together. So to my brothers on the panel, man, I appreciate y'all. Love y'all, man. And I got to really take off with my daughters that are coming. And if I'm not fully dressed, late, they're going to pull off on me. And then I'm going to get an earful. And you don't want it from no roughing girls.
All right, brother. I know it's going to take a while to put the bell bottoms on, but you know, we. big butterfly collar.
Joe was cleaning out his closet. And he sent me some of the things that he had still left over.
Don't wear that felt hat.
I tried to use my phone, but it didn't work. When he used to be a Soul Train dancer. I'm still waiting on the
Big Joe, final thoughts, bro.
Well, again, I was just looking at the numbers. There's somewhere between 800,000 and 1 million retired police officers in the United States. So those numbers, even if we just took 10% of that, do we make a difference? Certainly. And I think that particularly in places like Chicago, New York, L.A., even in Hewitt, you know, given the right impetus from the legal side, from the legislator, to make a difference. I think that part of the reform package should include that if we do it on a national basis.
And I'm just going to say I'm going to let the chief close this. For my final thought, if you're one of these people that's spitting out this defund the police slogan, why don't you get a copy of their budget first? Make sure you know what your police chief's name is. Make sure you know the name of the day shift, night shift, and afternoon shift sergeant. Make sure you know the names of the three officers that actually work your area. Know something about the police department other than jumping on to a defund the police slogan. And if that doesn't scare the daylights out of you, go look at the situation the city of Seattle is in right now, where they birthed that. And with that, final thoughts and take us out.
No, I mean, there's always, if we're not always trying to improve, then we're missing the mark. We should always strive to be better than what we were the day before. And, you know, there's room for everybody in this topic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's key among administrators and agencies to bring the stakeholders together to find out what it is that we want this to look at. Like, and that's the thing about the relationship building within that community. That's what sets the tone and drives what it is that we do. So that becomes important. And if the community's not coming to you, then you need to go to the community, right? And you need to figure out what direction it is that we need to go. So you got to step out, take care of business. And, I mean, again, I think in my career, we've done a lot. I think we've had a lot of great ideas and put some things out that have worked tremendously. But they didn't all come from me. They came from the two-year officer and the pastor up the street and, you know, the citizen. And, you know, so you got to take all that information in and create what it is that you want. We have problems. We have things that we need to figure out how to get out of our wheelhouse, like mental health, and get them the help that they need, homelessness, get them the help that they need. You know, so we continue to strive and figure out what those problems are and how to address them in an effective and efficient manner to alleviate problems. That's what we do. We're social workers and we're problem solvers. We've got to get better at doing that and alleviating these things. I think everything can be taken back down to that level. So with that, guys, hey, good to be back to see my friends and, you know, Saturday. So I'm not going to do anything today. I'm going to try to relax as much as I can.
There you go. I know what you're going to do, Chief. I know what you're going to do. You're going to be out on that patio.
I'm already out on the patio. You just can't tell because I got my thing there.
Oh, okay. Well,
it's better than barking dogs and a young one playing. I don't even know what game he's playing, screaming at the TV. So, you know, hey, we'll just
he's playing Fox News. No. We're going to get out. Appreciate everybody. Waco, Harrisburg, PA, ATL, Chicago, Hewitt, Texas, up there where John is. And we definitely appreciate John. You guys pray for John, you know, give him some strength. He's going through a lot, and he shared a lot here that he didn't have to do. We didn't know it was coming and didn't ask him to. But John's a straight-up guy. He's going to tell you, you know, he's not going to blow smoke. He's going to tell you what he believes. So we love him, and we're going to support him. And with that, we're going to get out. See you guys later.
Have a weekend, guys.
Recording.